You are a busy person, Paula Poundstone. You're doing so many things, but it feels like you've always been with us, always been around. I want to know a little bit about when you started deciding you were going to do what you do now and how you fell into it.
Well, the first sentence of the last paragraph of the summary letter written by my kindergarten teacher, those are drum cymbals, in May of 1965, says, "I have enjoyed many of Paula's humorous comments about our activities." I loved making people laugh. My kindergarten teacher appreciated me. I loved making people laugh from the time when I was very, very young. And I was lucky enough to be in Boston, bussing tables, earning a living, when the little comedy renaissance started up. And it actually happened in a lot of cities at about the same time. I've never really understood why, but there were a bunch of different places, San Francisco, Chicago, I don't know, a couple cities in Ohio, and on and on, and that started up like open mic circuits all about the same time. And that was 79.
And so then you got going on that, and then did things kind of happen organically from there, that you'd do an open mic, somebody would hear you, offer something else?
There was a bunch of us in each city, sort of vying for the paying jobs that were there. And I was really lucky because I got a job frequently, not every week, but frequently, emceeing the open mic night at a place called The Other Cafe in San Francisco. And I had taken a Greyhound bus around the country to see what clubs were like in different cities, and I ended up just staying in San Francisco because I loved it so much. The audiences in particular, the weather, I didn't really care for that much, but the audiences were red hot. And they would kind of follow you anywhere you wanted to go in terms of material. They were willing to take the ride, and I think they sort of liked the idea of being in on the ground floor of something. There was a feeling of excitement about stand-up comedy in the 1980s. But the great thing about emceeing this open mic night was that I would run out of material because about 30 people maybe would want to go up, maybe a little less than that, but something around there, and the premise of an open mic being that anybody wants who can go up and do 5 minutes. And so there'd be all these, comics or comic wannabes waiting to go on. And my job as the MC was to, have the audience sort of warmed up, keep the show moving on, keep the audience entertained in case some of the performers should be less than entertaining. Just introduce each person, which made for a lot of stage time for the MC. And so I would blow through my material within 10 minutes, probably. Then I would be forced to just sort of improvise and work the crowd. And it really was a great opportunity for getting comfortable on stage, getting used to being there. And it really cemented my relationship with San Francisco crowds.
And that's kind of the way we know you now, certainly, is the fact that you've never seemed like the kind of comedian that had your scripted material and your worked-out act and you honed it, saying exactly the same thing 23 times in a row. Have you ever had to do that?
I used to try really hard to, because I thought that was like the professional thing to do. And so I really strained to, fit a square peg into a round hole there. And by the way, I know guys who do the exact same thing every single night, and they do it brilliantly, and the audience loves it. There's nothing inherently wrong with doing that. I just couldn't. I couldn't for lots of reasons, not the least of which is, I'm very sort of moody on stage, I suppose. I get nervous, and when I get nervous, I can't remember things. And so memorizing an act was virtually impossible for me sometimes. And the other thing is I get distracted so easily. Something will get my attention that happens in the room or the way somebody's sitting or something somebody says or something I see. And the next thing I know, I'm off on the wrong topic entirely. It's very hard to swim back upstream to get to whatever it was I thought I was doing. And I sort of fought this impulse really from the early years when I was working. And eventually I realized you know, the joy and the really heart of the night tends to be in the parts where I had no, you know, where I had no idea what I was doing. You know, there's a great line in the movie Dumbo, the Walt Disney movie Dumbo, where Timothy Mouse is essentially his manager. And when they realize, when they realize that Dumbo can fly, and Timothy Mouse has figured it out, and Dumbo doesn't realize it yet. Timothy Mouse says to him, "Dumbo, the very thing that brought you down," which is his ears, because everybody made fun of him about his ears. He says, "The very thing that brought you down is going to bring you up, up, up." And that is some brilliant management advice. And I finally figured that out for myself. Like the fact that I couldn't stay on a script, the fact that I couldn't contain a linear thought for very long, once I sort of embraced that and allowed that, it really became the, you know, the most exciting part of what I do.
We've seen you several times. It's such a pleasure having you return to, I think this will be the third time or something like that, that you've done things for us. And we're so aware of everything that you've just said about how you've used the moment and the audience and somebody in the audience and just what's happening. I assume even through that, you have a pocket full of material just in case.
Oh, I have 38 years of material. And it rolls around in my head. I think it's a little bit like, you know those arcade games where you step into a booth and they blow money all around and you can keep whatever you can grab? That's sort of my material. You know, whatever I can grab, I use. But it's not in any particular order. And it's generally, you know, it's spurred on by, you know, my act is largely autobiographical. Oh, I love to think of jokes that I think are funny and tell them. And it's mostly, you know, my perceptions of things that, occur to me during the day. So it's largely autobiographical. I talk about raising a house full of kids and animals. I talk about trying to pay attention to the news well enough to cast a halfway decent vote. And then my favorite part of the night is just talking to the audience. I do the time-honored, where are you from, what do you do for a living? And in this way, little biographies of audience members emerge, and I use that from which to set my sails. It's my coordinates.
And of all the work you do, and I want to go through several aspects of the way you earn a living. We in public radio know you of so much through Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me. That probably kind of just even requires that you stay a little closer to politics and the world situation than you might otherwise do.
It was one of the luckiest days of my life when they called me up and asked me if I would do that show. You know, It's very rare, despite what the false image of reality television tries to portray. Reality television is scripted. It's just not well scripted. They just don't do a good job of it. But it's scripted. Going on Wait, Wait, the first time I did it, you know, we were not at that point in front of a live audience. We just did it via wire. I was at the NPR in Los Angeles. Adam was at the one in New York. Peter was in Chicago. Carl was in Washington, D.C., and on and on. And so we weren't even all together in one room. I had not done this before. I'd only heard the show on a tape one time. And, I put the goofy, silly, stupid radio headset on. And, the show begins, and I'm not really sure when to say what. And the director keeps coming out of my ear going, "Jump in whenever you want. Just say whatever you want," which is the polar opposite of most performing experiences outside of my own, you know, the show that I do myself.
And so...
It was wonderful. I mean, it's like, my favorite body of water to swim in is a river. And there was a real river feeling about jumping in with the Wait, Wait guys.
And so that was kind of an expedient way that you could do it electronically across the country. But I presume it's a lot more satisfying to be all in the same room where you can smell each other.
Oh, it's a better show altogether. You know, it is helpful as a performer to to have it's sort of like bowling with what do they call those things they put up?
Oh, the bumpers?
The bumpers, yeah. Doing comedy with a crowd in front of you is bowling with bumpers. You know, they tell you when you've come to the edge. You know, they tell you to, you know, move back over to the left or move back over to the right. It's helpful. And the energy that the crowd provides is, can't even be bottled.
Yeah. You know, I think that's why I myself so vastly prefer live interviews than even the one we're doing now, where we can't look at each other and grimace or something like that.
Oh, it does make like a that. Big difference, of yeah. course. Yeah, definitely.
It amazes me how Terry Gross can just kind of keep being so personal through all that.
I just recently heard that. That blew me away that she's not in the room with the person. Mm. It was a little bit, like finding out that there is no great and powerful Oz.
Yeah, it's pretty extraordinary. Well, let's jump to two of your current projects. You've had a book come out just about a month ago, and I know you've had plenty of opportunities to talk about the totally unscientific study of the search for human happiness. Did the title create the book, or did the book come along and then you made the title fit?
No, I guess the title created the book to some degree. I mean, I had the idea, long before the sort of happiness idea was sort of a genre of sorts. I had this idea after my last book came out, so it was several years ago, and part of my, part of the evil genius of my idea was I was thinking that, so the premise of the book is I did things that either I or other people thought would make me happy, but as I'm going through those experiences, I measure this based on how it impacts my regular life. Not just whether I enjoy doing the thing, but whether it provides an umbrella of sorts, a bounce, so that when I get back to my regular life, an umbrella to protect from the inevitable on and off rains of one's daily life. So every chapter is written as an experiment with the hypothesis and the conditions and, qualitative and quantitative observations and hopefully the funniest field notes ever written. But the analysis part of every chapter is just a story of raising a house full of kids and animals and being a stand-up comic and just being stuck being me 24 hours a day. But my original idea, and here was the evil genius, my original idea was that I would do these things and the publisher would pay for them. That was part of the genius of it, was that I could go do some exotic activity and the publisher would pay for it. And as it turns out, that's not what happened. But it was a great idea. I'd like to find a publisher that thinks that's a great idea.
There you go. Yeah, I want to actually take an issue with you calling it an unscientific study, because in a way it was very scientific, because you were the lab.
I was just acknowledging, I guess, that, for example, I mean, some chapters... the first chapter is the Get Fit experiment, and I very dutifully went to a place down the street from my house, a Taekwondo self-defense teacher. He's got a studio there. It's, it's close by, and I went in. I signed up for as many classes. I bring my calendar with me and signed up for as many classes as I could over, whatever the first month was, and the experiment went on for months. And they were grueling workouts, just like unlike anything I could possibly have convinced myself to do on my own. One day I was walking down the alley carrying a couple of bags, trash bags of animal waste and kitty litter, going out to the big garbage cans, and it occurred to me that I felt good. And I thought, it is clearly the exercising, because I've carried animal waste down the alley before, and I don't ever recall getting a boost from it. And so I really did within doing that experiment. I took notes. I took careful notes and documented all this as I went along. I definitely was feeling better. There was no question in my mind that I was feeling better from doing this exercise. But then when I felt like, okay, I had the data that I needed and now I needed, you know, to move on to the next experiment, well, I had to quit that exercising. And when I was talking to my editor about it later, this is, you know, years after I'd done these things, when she was editing the book, she kept saying, well, why would you have stopped if you were feeling good? She didn't understand why the reader would appreciate. She goes, well, they're not going to believe it if you stopped. I go, no, I stopped for science. I stopped because I needed to control the variable in the next experiment. However, there were some that were less scientific. For example, one of the experiments is the Get Wired experiment where I learned to use a computer. And sadly, after I learned to use a computer, I did continue to use it. I did not stop so to control the variables in the next experiments. And by the way, I'm fairly certain the computer is ruining my life.
Well, and you brought that out last time you were here, and you took off on flat things, and you changed my life just with those two words of flat things, because I've been searching for a name for all of those things. And so thank you.
All the flat things, none of them are good for you.
Yeah, thank you.
That's absolutely true. And I know because, interestingly, I mean, my son, I'm sure I've told you, my son suffered from very severe electronics addiction. But the other thing is, in the course of my experiment, I actually did come to it almost a blank slate on the topic. I mean, I knew my son had some sort of entanglements with it. I didn't thoroughly understand it at the point at which I began using the silly, stupid thing. But I went out and I bought a laptop because you can bring a laptop door to door and beg for help. But I knew almost nothing. And I learned how to use the thing. And right away, I fell down the same rabbit hole that so many have. The difference is that because I was documenting the experience, not realizing what was going to happen to me, but because I was documenting the experience and because I started from a pretty, I didn't use this stuff place, it actually is pretty clear the problems that it can cause, you know. That feeling of that you need to check it all the time, that sort of feeling of unrest, it screwed up my sleep schedule very early on, although in truth my sleep schedule is a little raggedy to begin with because of travel and because I do radio interviews early in the morning. But I feel that in that way it was a scientific advance.
And so at that point, I want to say that you can negate everything you just said by talking about what you just did on June 6th. You recorded a podcast.
I'm not saying that I haven't gone over to the dark side. I'm just saying I'm aware that I've gone over to the dark side. I did. I recorded a podcast. It's actually going to begin being available. I believe it rolls out somewhere around July 8th, I think. And it's called Live from the Poundstone Institute. Now, people who may be familiar with Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me know that Peter Sagal, my boss and the host of Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, often presents questions about studies. He'll say there was a study in this or there was a study in that. And it's often, he'll tell me some very unlikely fact about a study. And it's usually stuff that you can't figure out why anybody would study it to begin with. Here's just one example. One time he said, there's a study that proved that cats were the only animal who don't forgive. And I just was like, who did that study? Who paid them? Why would they do that? And how can you tell when a rhino has forgiven you anyways? And Peter, he can tell me the result of the study. He can very rarely tell me who did it, why they did it. And maybe what the procedure for it was. So at the Poundstone Institute, at Live from the Poundstone Institute, I record in front of a live audience in Los Angeles, a small but lively live audience. And among other things, I have a chance to talk to the scientists who do the studies. It's a comedy show. It's a funny show. It's me and Adam Felber, who's also from Wait, Wait. But a chance to go to go further in depth with these study people.
Well, I think we've got to rename you Professor Poundstone, and we'll look forward to seeing you with your lab coat from the Poundstone Institute when you take the price of a plane ride to come and entertain us on the 22nd. Thanks a lot.
I'm looking forward to it. Thank you so much. Take care.
You're welcome.